Well, as long as we're owning up to mistakes that we made, the truth is I didn't really intend to come up here and sit down because I haven't been doing that. I've just been coming from right there. The truth is I thought we were going to stand to pray and realized, well, the best way out of this without looking like an idiot is just go ahead and come up front and and that's the truth. That's actually what happened. And I thought, what, did Brandy forget to stand or think we were standing too and did the same thing? I honestly didn't realize you hadn't done that until you said. But it has been a little bit of a long day. I'm just hoping I can muddle my way through. You all are awfully kind in your remarks toward me. I can't really make any promises about this evening or any other evening for that matter. As I was thinking about that, I was reminded of a story I heard one time about a preacher who made the announcement to the congregation from the pulpit that he was going to be leaving that congregation. And there was a lady, elderly lady, that just began sobbing uncontrollably. And that kind of touched him, so he, after it was all over with and he was shaking hands with people, he singled her out and he said, "Ma'am," he said, I just want to tell you that they'll probably get somebody here after me that's twice as good as I am, and you won't miss me at all after a little while." And she said, "No, I used to think that too, but they just keep getting worse and worse and worse." One of the things that I was glad of, sometimes when I'm preaching a meeting, I'm kind of locked into things. The elders here did not necessarily tell me I had to be locked into what I was going to be preaching on, and this is kind of a last-minute change. Originally, my plan was to preach on calling on God and worship, and although that's certainly a valid topic, for whatever reason, I decided to go a different route this evening, and it probably is not quite as tightly connected to the theme I selected as the others. And we're going to be reading tonight from Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 20. And this one is about homes, fathers, and children. And we probably won't talk much about calling on the name of the Lord to the very end, when hopefully that gets bound all together. I told somebody a while ago the title of this lesson's Horses, Wives, and Gold, and that's one potential title. You can remember it that way if you like, but that's just part of the lesson. What we're about to read is God's orders given through Moses regarding the king who would one day rule in Israel. Now, those of you who study the Bible, and if you're particularly interested in the Old Testament, there's something about that statement that may seem just a little bit strange to us. Because when they finally did get a king in Israel, it was not in harmony with the will of God. And yet, all the way back here in Deuteronomy chapter 17, you had God saying when it happens, which demonstrates that he knew that it would happen. In fact, I would argue that the Messiah concept of Jesus was in part based on the notion that there would one day be a king in Israel. I don't know, maybe you could just say it was a matter of timing. Maybe God's timetable wasn't the same as that of the people. There is no doubt that what they did in asking for a king during the day of Samuel wasn't pleasing God. God punished them for it. But at the same time, at the very least, what we can say is God knew it was going to happen and wanted to give some principles for kings. Now, there are no kings here this evening. I'm pretty confident of that. No kings, no queens. But what we actually have, in my judgment, are some invaluable principles that are applied to homes. If you're a mom or a dad, or you ever plan to be one, you might want to listen carefully. Maybe even if you're a grandma or grandpa, You might want to pay attention to some of the things we're going to talk about. Let's read it together. Beginning in verse 14, "When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. And it shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it. He shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in the kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel." Much of what I'm going to say tonight is directed, I would say, more to fathers than mothers. In my opinion, we have a fatherhood crisis in this country. I don't think I ever really became aware of what kind of a problem we had until my kids began playing little league ball. And it was disheartening to me to see, and I guess I was naive, but many of you know what I'm about to say to you. You think you're going to meet parents in the traditional sense, and even in a place like St. Mary's, West Virginia, which is pretty old-fashioned, that's not what you get. Dad brings the boy to the game, and he's there with his new wife, and mom takes him home with her new husband. And that's not the exception. That's the rule. And over here's grandma and grandpa who are doing the same thing, because mom or dad, one or the other, maybe one of them is too drug addicted to take care of children, and the other parent doesn't care enough to pick up the slack. You know, there was such a thing as divorce, there was such a thing as single parent homes when I was a kid. I gotta be honest with you, I didn't know about any of those personally. It just didn't happen. And it's amazing to look back and say, this is how much things have changed in such a relatively short time, where the basic family unit has been utterly disrupted and destroyed, to the point now that people think it's strange if it's mom and dad and the kids. It's unusual. And don't think it's not having an effect. It is. Oh, it's having a tremendous effect. You want to know where crime in the cities originates? Now, people will give you crime statistics for various races, for instance. Ann Coulter pointed out that when one removes the variable of single-parent homes, the differences in crime rates among the races disappears. Well, what's all that mean? It means that the real problem is we don't have dads in homes. That's what's going on. And many of these moms are doing the very best that they can, remember Dad used to call men like that, you know, he'd call them a drone. Because with the bees, you know, the bees, the workers are the female bees. The drones are only there to reproduce with the queen. That's all they do. They don't do a thing except eat the honey. And he always said there were some men like that. That's the only thing they did was reproduce. And then they were either gone or if they were there, they weren't worth much. They were drones. He always liked to point out in the fall of the year, they eliminate the hive of all those drones because they're a complete waste of time at that point. I'm of the opinion that what we think of dads in this country has mirrored what we think of God. And I'm also quite certain that it was no coincidence that the God of this universe, who is not a man, who is neither a male nor a female, but nonetheless chose deliberately to identify himself as Father and did it for a reason. And I think it has something to do with the first words that most babies speak. The first word that most babies say is some form of daddy. And I think this is the reason why. The child is carried for 9 months, literally inside his mother's body. They have a physical bond that extends throughout life. The instinctive view of mother is unconditional, constant love. I remember reading many years ago about an incident that took place in a prison. I don't know where it was. But Hallmark Cards decided we're going to have this program. We're going to come in here and we're going to, for free of charge, we're going to have cards that these inmates can fill out and send to their mothers on this Mother's Day. And it was an enthusiastic, roaring success. In fact, it was such a success that they said, we're going to do the same thing on Father's Day. And about two men showed up for Father's Day. You know why? Because if they had one, he was worthless. And it was no coincidence that the prison was full of men who had fathers who weren't dads. So anyway, you got this connection with mother that is constant. But it seems like even before the birth and then through infancy, there is this process that's beautiful to behold where mom is essentially creating a connection between dad and child through various means. Instinctively, she wants him to be a part of that. She wants that bond desperately. And what's the baby do? The baby is born, I believe very strongly, with this instinctive need to connect with dad. You say, why not with mom? Because the connection's there. It's always going to be there. What he's searching for is the man who is my father. Now, you might think that dada comes before mama because it's easier for a baby to say. Would you find it interesting to learn that it's the same in every language? In every language on earth, babies say daddy before they say mama. And I think God put that something in us so that we might learn from this human and physical but spiritual connection about something else. In other words, to say to all the children on this earth, you need to find me. And I think that most of the things that people are doing today that are harmful to themselves, they're doing because they don't have the connection with their spiritual father. And they miss it, and it hurts them. And the things they're doing, they don't realize, but they're trying to make that connection with Father who loves them. And so, what God had to say to kings on this occasion turns out to be the principles that fathers ought to use to bring their children to the Lord. Let's look at verse 15 first. In verse 15, the commandment is, you shall not have a stranger, we'd say a foreigner, who will become king over you. That one might make you scratch your head a little bit. You mean there were occasions when foreigners would just come out from another country and be our king? You couldn't do that in America. You have to be born in this country, and that's the case most places that we know anything about. No, in those days, it was not uncommon to have a stranger or a foreigner come in and be your king. The thought was, if we could get a successful general, he could lead us in war. And yes, you can be king over us even though you are from another country. God said, if you're going to lead my people, you're going to be one of my people. If you're going to lead your home, you're going to lead it in fellowship, as one. You're not going to lead them from afar. You need to be there. There's no other way to do it. David was an absentee father. There's no other way to describe it. He was an absentee father. In 1 Kings chapter 1 and verse 6, now 1 Kings chapter 1 describes yet another rebellion by one of David's sons against him, this one by Adonijah. Now keep in mind that since David's sin with Bathsheba, he has seen one son rape another daughter and had that son killed by another son, Absalom, and then seen that son arise in rebellion and had him killed, while David, I think, probably felt like he was powerless to do much because everybody knew what he had gotten into, and he made a grave error there. He should have taken his lumps. He should have said, yes, I did something terrible, but we're not going to behave that way. But what the Bible says about Adonijah is so interesting to me. When it says in chapter 1 and verse 6, and his father had not said to him at any time, why have you done so? It also says he was a goodly man or good looking. His mother bare him after Absalom. But I think you have a lot of insight as to what happened with Absalom too. But I have to laugh every time I read that verse. His father had never said, why have you done so? The reason I'm laughing is because my dad, number one, he displeased me plenty. But interestingly enough, one of his favorite phrases was, why did you do that? When I was a little kid, you know, you'd do something wrong. Dad wouldn't say, did you do that? He'd always say, why did you do that? I never had a good answer. The answer is, Dad, I don't know. What I really wanted was you to come and yell at me and then beat me. That's what I wanted. Now, I said that on the inside. I never said that on the outside. That would have been a bad move. Why is it that he had no real control over these boys, though? You know what the answer is? He had a wife over here in this house, a wife over here in this house, a wife in this house, a wife in that house. He couldn't be dad. He was an absentee father. I know God allowed it. I also know God never really endorsed what he or his son Solomon did in having all these wives. And it shows in their families. He was an absentee father. He had no fellowship with them. David probably bought them nice gifts. But he wasn't there to be able to say, no, we're not going to do that. I bet he never took a switch to Adonijah. Oh, I know, we're not supposed to say that today. I'll say it a dozen more times. You can call whoever. Take a switch, take a switch, take a switch. DJ had a board about this long made out of oak. And he got it frequently. I'm glad I did it. My dad was big on a switch. He thought a switch could cure anything. It was either a switch or a belt. And Dad would tell people, he'd say, boy, a switch is a great thing to use on them. He'd say, it hurts, but it's hard to really harm them with a switch. It just hurts, and it hurts for a little while. When I was about 17, Dad supplemented his income for a while selling encyclopedias. And I went with him this day. And we went to some folks' house in close to Clendenin. And have you ever been to somebody's house where you were just alarmed at what the kids are doing, but the parents seem oblivious and you're nervous as a cat? You ever been in that situation? I've never seen two boys like this. One was about 4 and the other was about 6. And I can't even begin to tell you all that they were into. All I remember is nobody's paying any attention. The 6-year-old has a brick like this and threw it at the other one's head and just missed. And nobody's saying anything. I'm about to lose my mind. So we go in, and Dad's talking to him about encyclopedias, and here's the boys doing this and this and that and the other. And while they're doing that, I'm watching him. Dad had a hairline about like mine. And us 5 kids, we would call this part of his head the light bulb. And the reason we called it that is when he laughed hard, it would turn bright red. Now, I'm telling you that, and now I know I got the same thing. I found that out because DJ and Thomas said, yeah, you got the same thing. We call it the avatar. But it showed up when he laughed real hard or when he was mad. And whether he looked mad or not, that was the tell. That thing starts, and I'm watching that thing, and it's getting redder and redder and redder, and I thought he's going to blow. And finally, I can remember like anything, he shut the book and he said, lady, I've raised 5 kids and I want to tell you, you need to get a hold of those boys. And I thought, well, they're going to throw us out. She started crying. She said, I know, I don't know how. I've taken them to the psychologist. I've done this. And Dad said, oh, that's not what you need. He said, let me show you how to cut a switch and switch them. And her mom lived with her, and she comes out of the kitchen. That's what I've been telling her. So we go outside. Dad takes her over to this tree, shows her which would be a good switch to use on them, cuts it off with his pocket knife, and when we drove away, she was beating the thunder out of those two boys. I felt like the Lone Ranger. Our work is done here, ma'am. Sort of think, looking back, though, one of the problems was Dad wasn't around there to be able to take them and control them. No, fellowship isn't all about that. It's also about having a connection with our kids where we have an influence. Let me tell you about an interesting verse that tells you about fellowship and being one of the family. It's Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15. It's a verse we've all heard a dozen times. If it seem evil to you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods that your fathers served, which were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. That's Joshua saying to the people, you're going to need to serve God. You're going to need to put away these idols. But the last thing he says is this, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Joshua is saying, in my home, we're not going to put up with any nonsense. In my home, as long as I have any say over my children, we are going to serve the Lord. You know how old Joshua was when he said that? He was 110. Now think about that for a minute. So he's talking about kids that are 85. Now you 85-year-olds, you better not step out of line. That's what he said. Well, obviously they could if they wanted to. The point was Joshua was confident that at 80 or 85 or how old these children were, that they were on the same page because of what he had done when they were 10 and 15. As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Joshua knew he had a real connection with his children. Let's go on and see about the horses, wives, and gold, which represent the priorities in the kingdom. That's in verses 16 and 17. There were three things he was not to multiply: horses, wives, and gold. Now, the gold, I mean, it speaks for itself, but you wonder what is wrong with gathering horses? Well, the answer was that horses, especially at this point in history, horses represented military power. The king of my people shall not be someone who is obsessed with his own importance and power in the world. How many people have you read about, and I don't mean the Bible or anything, I'm just talking about in the newspaper, how many great and powerful people have you read about whose children are a complete mess? Many. That's how many. And I suspect that oftentimes it's because that they were willing to say, whatever it is I'm pursuing in this world is more important than the children that God has given me and for whom I'm responsible. And what they do is they create a gap between themselves and their children. And sometimes those children doing what all children do, looking up to and seeking their father. They would love to do that. But because they've been rejected so many times, there's a gap and it can't be filled. Saul was a king who unfortunately fell prey to all of these. Solomon's probably the best example of one who fell prey to all these, but I'm going to talk to you about Saul because what happened between him and David? And what's interesting is back in 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 26, we have an incident that took place between Saul and David. Now, at this point in their lives, Saul, because of his obsession with his own self-importance and his own pursuits, his own selfishness, he has been attempting to find and capture and kill David because he considers him a threat to his kingdom. Saul was David's father-in-law. Saul was David's best friend's father. Those two things alone should have been enough to have called off Saul's pursuit. They were not. David, because of his respect of the position of king, has already had an opportunity to kill Saul in the cave at En-Gedi, and he refused to do so. But when Saul was a distance away, they spoke to one another. He was a distance that they could speak, but nonetheless he was safe from Saul. And on that occasion he called Saul my father, and Saul called him my son. But what's interesting here is the second occasion, Saul, or rather David and his most trusted men, crept into the camp of Saul and his army while they were sleeping, came right over top of the sleeping Saul, could have killed him, and I feel certain that they could have done so without awaking the others around them. They were pretty good at that sort of thing. But instead, all they did was they took his spear, which was stuck in the ground beside him, they took his canteen. And once again, when they were a safe distance away, David speaks. And he says, Saul, essentially, you ought to get better help, Saul. The men you have working for you as generals let us right in there. We could have killed you. Saul, overcome with his own embarrassment, not just over the incident, but over his behavior, the Bible says Saul knew his voice. And he said, is that your voice, my son David? But listen to the difference as David returns and answers this time. David said, it is my voice, my Lord, O King, not Father. It would be the last time that Saul ever enjoyed hearing from the one who had once been like a son to him, and for all intents and purposes was a son to him, but he would never call Saul father again. Why? Because Saul had become obsessed with his own pursuits and was willing to sacrifice David to those. The second thing that he says kings and fathers ought not pursue is wives. I mentioned already that during this period, of course, God allowed that which was not ideal, and that is polygamy, that is the taking of multiple wives. But even then, it wasn't wives. And he warns this pursuit of sensuality is selfishness. It will harm your children. I believe it harmed David's children. I already told you that. We see all over the country people who will tell you, God doesn't want me to be unhappy. I've had people tell me that more than once. It's like the reading from a script. They'll decide that their lives and their families aren't exciting enough, and here's somebody that makes me feel young again. And sometimes they'll sit down and talk with me about it, or pretend to, and they'll say, I don't believe God wants me to be unhappy. I'm done ever holding my tongue on that one again. Wait a minute. God doesn't want you to be unhappy. Okay, let's see what you're saying here. God doesn't want you to be unhappy, but he does want your wife to be unhappy. He wants your children to be unhappy. He wants your parents and her parents to be unhappy. He wants everybody else to be happy, but you, you special little fella, you're supposed to be happy. Is that what we're saying here? Tired of it. The Proverbs writer says in Proverbs 5, verses 18 and 19, let thy fountain be blessed, and rejoice always with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind, the pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And again, this was during the time period when one could add another wife if he had the financial means to do so. But the Proverbs writer, who was Solomon, basically is saying that's a poor idea. You'll be happier if you two grow old together. Don't multiply wives. Gold, as I said before, kind of is self-explanatory. Don't become obsessed with getting ahead. You know, I'm afraid that that's our excuse for a lot of things. Have you noticed that Americans don't have any time for anything anymore? And they really don't. You'll try to get somebody to come to church services with you, and they're not really making an excuse. They really don't have any time. Now, in a sense, that's not an excuse, because the reasons they don't have any time aren't very good reasons, but they have so many commitments. And at this point in history, you know, there's no such thing as kids just playing ball. We have to have a league now. Have to have a league for everything. Well, that takes up several nights a week right there. And then somebody says, well, we both have to work. And we both have to work extra, and we both have to work overtime. But the reason we have to do all those things is because we have all these things and we now have to pay for them. Whatever happened to doing without until you can afford something? We don't believe that in America anymore. We want everything. We want it now. And now we are slaves. And if you think that I'm speaking against being successful, I'm certainly not. I really am not. I'm always happy when somebody does well. I really am. I'm happy when members of the church, when somebody gets good news, whether it's spiritual news or physically good news, I'm happy when people get a good job. I'm happy when they get ahead. I really am. But the problem is we're not thinking about what we're sacrificing sometimes to get there. And some of us are sacrificing our children to get there. Dads, I want you to listen some. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Bet you've heard it before. It reads, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but delegate, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord to your wife." Is that what it reads? Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, and you better hope you have a good, committed woman to raise them, because all you're supposed to do is provide a paycheck. Is that what it reads? Isn't that what a lot of us are doing? God placed us at the head of the house for a reason. And that is direct spiritual training. Our kids were little. Mary Amy sat me down and said, "You're messing something up." And I'm happy to give her credit for this. I really am. Because I wasn't thinking about this. She said, "The boys, you need to be reading the Bible with them every night. And it needs to be you." I didn't like hearing that, because that meant, you know, nobody likes a criticism, but it was a good criticism. And I thought about that verse, and I thought, yeah, I've been leaving that up to Mom. A lot of dads have the idea that being close to God is something when they're very young kids, and maybe something to come back into right before I die. And I sure hope my kids do the right thing, but I'm not going to. I'm going to send them, I'm going to push them, I'm going to encourage them, but I'm not going to lead them. And it won't work. Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, Jesus is doing the speaking. He said unto them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness. For man's life consisteth not of the abundance of the things which he possesseth." The third feature is regarding the book. It was an amazing command, and I wish that I knew. This is something I certainly wish that the Old Testament told us, and it didn't. But it says that when the king came to the throne, what he was supposed to do was sit down and write a copy of the Bible. He was supposed to sit down and get one of the priests who were in charge. They had the scrolls. "Bring that to me. And my first order of business as king is I'm going to sit down and I'm going to handwrite a copy of the Bible." I don't know how long that would take. Bible was smaller then, so that's some help. And yet, I never read of it happening. I hope it did with some of them, but I don't know that it did. Let me throw this at you. What kind of a country would this be if the first thing President Trump had done when he was elected, not even inaugurated, but elected, was to say, "First thing I need to do is get a copy of the Bible and spend, I don't even need him to write it and copy it. I just need him to read it and believe it." You think that'd be a good thing? Can you imagine what the country would have been like if the last 10 presidents, upon knowing I'm going to have to lead this country, they said, "The first thing I'm going to need is a copy of the Bible, and I'm going to spend every day just reading it." Wouldn't that be great? Dads and moms, if you're going to lead precious little people, you need to know what the book says. Going to have to. There's no way around it. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 through 9, Moses gives his instructions. This is part of his final instructions to people. And he said, "The words that I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently. Let me stop there. Let's go back. Thou shalt teach them diligently. You know what? You're not going to be able to teach them diligently unless they're in your heart. And I didn't mean in the computer or in a book. They have to be in your heart. Not just in your mind. Not meaning that you just know about them, but that you believe them and they're precious to you. How many times you heard people say it didn't matter what people felt toward God in the Old Testament? They don't know what they're talking about, do they? This said the words of God need to be in your heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently to thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest down. And thou walkest by the way, when you liest down, when you rise up. I want you to notice that it doesn't read. Now, you parents, you will have God's law in your heart, and then you will hope that they learn what they need to know in Bible class at church. Does anybody read that in this? Because I don't. This says that the primary instructor of children, parents. That's where it's going to come from. Bible classes are wonderful. I'm not against Bible classes. I'm for Bible classes. But that won't get the job done. It's up to us. And you're going to talk about these things at various times. When the questions are asked, you're going to be there to answer them. Then he said, thou shalt bind them as a sign upon thine hands. Which the Jews misconstrued, incidentally. He's not saying write that on the little leather box and have it on your... He said make it be like that. That'd be like us saying it'll be like a string tied around your finger. He said, they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. Thou shalt write them on the posts of thy house and on thy gates. In other words, this is going to be what really defines you. He didn't just say, read it. He didn't just say, write it. He said, you're going to need to live by it. In fact, if you notice in verse 19, he says that you may learn to fear the Lord your God. What does that mean exactly? Several minutes ago, I said that we have come to misunderstand what it means to have a father in this country. And thus we have come to misunderstand what it means to have a heavenly father. And this is part of it. Now, I'm not blaming people who say this. What they say is perfectly true. And I'm not even trying to undo what people have said. But I think that by saying what I'm about to, that we have missed part of this feature. Because people will always say, now, what this means, fear God, it means to respect him. And that's certainly true. It does mean to respect him. I'm afraid that we've forgotten how to fear the sovereign king of the universe. We're not afraid of God anymore. When I was 6 years old, my older brother had shown me how that gasoline will burn. And so I got the bright idea that I was going to melt the wheels off of a truck of mine. And I won't go into all the details of what was in my mind. But anyway, I had this plan, and I decided I was going to light a puddle of gasoline in order to do it. And so I got the gasoline. I was out in the garage. The garage had a dirt floor. And I poured me out a puddle of gasoline. I thought, well, no, that's too big. And I went over here, and I poured another puddle. No, that's too small. And I went here and poured. By the time I got back and finally got the puddle that I thought was just the right size, I had created a ring of gasoline around me. Then I got the match, and I lit that one, not realizing I was lighting the whole thing. Next thing I know, I didn't know who Johnny Cash was when I was six, but I was in a ring of fire. And I jumped out, and I ran into the house. And I told my mom, I said, the garage is on fire. And my brother was standing there helping him sort eggs that we were buying from a farmer. And as he will tell you to this day, my life flashed in front of me because he figured the finger would eventually come back to him. And I can still remember him. He dropped both eggs in his hand and they smashed on the floor. Well, they called the fire department. Mom said, "How did that fire start?" I was 6 years old and I said, "I think a drunk did it." And she gave me a look and walked away. Honestly, I thought it was a pretty good story for 6 years old, really. But my conscience got to bothering me, and I told her, "No, I started it." She said, "Well, I thought so." And then I had to wait. Because Dad was over at the local drugstore. He'd go over there and have a cup of coffee. And this was about the time of day he'd do that. And he'd heard the trucks go by. Of course, he didn't have any idea what they were about. But I had to wait. And I waited, and finally he came home. Now, I told you, Dad believed in the switch and the belt. And as my brother always said, he was like a quick draw artist with a gun with that belt. He'd go for it. I don't have any idea. He got it unbuckled that fast. But he'd go for it, and it would come out of those loops whoosh, like that. And so he came home, and we had a talk, sort of. He went back to the drugstore after a while. Somebody said, "Bob, we heard there was a fire over at your place." He said, "No, there were two fires." He said, "My son lit one, and I lit the other." You know, when Dad showed up, I wasn't standing there saying, "Boy, I respect him." And yet, the thought never entered my mind at any time when I was a child. It never even occurred to me to think Dad might harm me. Never even occurred to me. I knew he would. I never thought he's going to break a bone. I'm going to have to go to the hospital. None of that. I'd have been afraid even if I didn't know about the belt, though. Because, yeah, respect, but also fear. Because he's my superior. We come to God now. We think we're coming to him on an equal footing. I was listening to the radio a few years ago. You might have heard this. I didn't realize I was listening to a religious song. I just thought it was a song. And all of a sudden, the words caught my ear. It was a song called "I Can Only Imagine." And the guy was saying, "I don't know whether I'm going to fall down on my face, bow down before God, or dance in front of him." And I just about wrecked a car. I thought the greatest men who ever lived on this earth, when they were face to face with God, they end up flat on their faces, petrified, terrified. And this joker thinks he's going to dance. He's not afraid of God in the least. I am. I'm afraid of God. And I don't mean I go to bed every night just and can't sleep for fear that he's going to do something unjust to me. I know he loves me. I'm afraid of God. And I'm afraid that we've forgotten how to be afraid of God. Do you want your children to call in the name of the Lord? This is when I said I was tying things together. Do you want to introduce your children, or maybe even your grandchildren, to the Father? You're going to have to follow some of these principles. David didn't, and it was such a tragedy. In Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 33, he's just found out that Absalom has died. And I think he's pretty confident about where Absalom is at this point. And he cries with an inconsolable grief. He's there in the gate of the city. He's ready to receive the army back because they have defeated the army of Absalom, but he'd given instructions that Absalom isn't to be harmed. And his question is, the messengers come back, the young man Absalom, is he safe? And the second messenger said in a very tactful way, no, he's not. I'm afraid he's dead. Now, what happened with Absalom and David and the picture that the Bible gives us here, so much insight. David is overcome with emotion, so much so that he doesn't want anybody to see him weep. And the Bible says he went up to the chamber over the gate and he wept. But as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. I know you want those that God has entrusted you with. I know you want them to do the right thing. I know I do as well. I know you want them to be right. Maybe this evening you're not a child of God. And again, I've known some people who felt that they could push people to Christ. And it doesn't really work. You have to lead them. But maybe you're not a Christian. You know what the first thing you need to do is? You need to fix that. You need to be right with God. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. If you're outside of Christ this evening, we're going to sing a song to invite you to become a Christian. It's our hope and prayer that you'd heed that call. Will you come as we stand and sing?